thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
You know, it's so great to go back and listen to all of these old clips, and I think the temptation is there right from the start, from the very first clip, to pull out your scorecard and see what we got right in terms of our predictions and what we got wrong. And I think, you know, on balance, we did pretty well. But what really interests me as we sort of go back through time over the last 6 years on this podcast is really how much we focused a little bit less on the actual details, I guess, of the technology and more about the kind of social context and the interplay of technology with human beings. And I think if the podcast has done anything right over the past 6 years, I think it's really been on this point that we've really approached these new technologies, things like Google Docs or Second Life or Facebook, not with an eye on, per se, on user interfaces or what's going on the server, but really with an analysis of how these technologies fit into their social environments. And it's really from that, which I guess we're borrowing from our practice as historians and humanities scholars, thinking about really how technologies, I guess, win or lose, if you want to put it that way, succeed or fail, based not upon really what they can do or the details of what they can do, and more about how they're situated within different communities. And I think it was from that and those insights that we've been most successful in sort of figuring out, you know, that Facebook would be, you know, really successful and Second Life would not. I think on balance, we've tended to be able to tease out at least a little direction some of these technologies are going in.
Kind of makes you wonder if the operating system is quickly approaching the time when it's sort of irrelevant. If you've got your web browser and you've got, you know, fairly decent apps in your web browser, what does it matter? I would love it if my students submitted their papers just virtually through Google Docs. I could look back at, you know, revisions that they've made. I could comment on a rough draft just online. Seems to me like there's a lot of advantages here.
Yeah, that would be really pretty great. And for me, I contemplated that this semester, actually, and it was the lack of a footnote feature was the thing that kept me from doing it.
Having a bibliography on the page or something that, you know, further reading that isn't just other links to websites but actually includes books is a great place to start.
There was some lighter news, of course, about Wikipedia. Sinbad was declared dead over the weekend.
He was dead for a whole week. Yeah, he was dead for a whole week, wasn't he?
Was it a whole week? I guess his daughter called him and said, I just checked on Wikipedia. It says you're dead. And he said on the phone to her that that wasn't actually the case. And how was
I suppose it's not entirely false. I mean, his career has been dead since the early 90s,
right.
I think.
That's so. Right. Maybe it was some kind of metaphorical entry. But it'll be interesting to see what, you know, is NBC News going to put up free content or is this just entertainment content that'll go up on these sites, the SNLs, clips from SNL or something like that. And I think Vint gave a pretty interesting talk where
he sort of reminded people that everything of value is not found through a Google search, which everyone giggled about. And of course, they're trying to change that by digitizing everything that they can get their hands on. And he actually came to sort of talk about a 1,000-year view, which I thought was pretty interesting. I mean, I don't really see, for instance, how the Google scans, which are not really that high quality, are going to really last for 1,000 years. So I'm not quite sure where he was going with that. And actually, after his talk, he received a little bit of flack from certain parties in the audience who were saying that, you know, Google has its own best interests at heart and not those of libraries or universities. Anyway, and of course, Vint Cerf responded very comically to that by telling those people that he'd meet them in the alley with a pistol after the meeting.
I think to any historian is going to see a sort of 1,000-year view as kind of problematic. I mean, it's very difficult to see what's going to happen in 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years. Never mind 1,000. But it is good, I think, that they're at least talking that way and thinking that way. Whether they're actually making any progress in that direction, that's another question. But it sounds good.
People with real money to spend on this, and I think that's what's really going to make the difference over the next few years is the recognition that doing significant work in digital humanities requires money.
Also this week, we saw the launch of Google My Maps, and we've been doing a lot of these Google Maps mashups, and we've discussed it, I believe, on an earlier podcast. But I think what's exciting here is, for those who haven't seen it yet, it's become suddenly much easier for people, in our case, you know, students and faculty and staff at universities or museums and libraries to sort of place little indicators of different items onto a Google map. And I think that really presents, up to this point, you had to have a little bit more technical sophistication or knowledge to actually do these kinds of map mashups. But I think with the launch of My Maps, I think we're going to see a lot more sort of bubbling up from below. I certainly plan to use it in my Western Civ class because it just makes it much easier for students to put things onto a map and to collaborate on a map and so forth.
I subsequently had a conversation with our dean of students about it, so I thought I would just set up a Facebook page in part to show students that grown-ups also can have Facebook accounts and see what's going on there. And so I set up the page and then invited all the students in my Western Civ class that semester to add me as a friend, and I came into class the next day and they were all freaked out, like, how did you get a Facebook account? And I said, well, I have a .edu email address and that's all that's required. Yeah, but you're a professor. And so we had a conversation about making sure that they were a little more discreet with some of the things that they were doing.
You know, I just look back at the history of computing. You know, when I was in high school and college in the 1980s, you know, computing actually was the area where all the loners hung out. And I have to admit, you know, I was one of those kind of nerdy people. You know, I think it was a retreat in some sense from the social world. And I think it's very interesting, considering what we discussed last week, to notice that just in the last decade, really, computing has really moved in the mainstream, but also because of the connection of personal computers to the internet, it really is a very social realm. And I think people who don't participate in that realm, you know, I think it's very indicative of, you know, what's going on, mentally. And I think it's an area that I think we often forget about. I think, you know, one of the things that's really difficult probably for a lot of students when they participate in MySpace or Facebook is, you know, these places, they really quantify in a very forward way, you know, how many friends you have and who you're connected to. And, you know, that can be very difficult, I think, for a lot of, you know, I remember when I was younger, you know, to think about how many friends you had or who you had friends with. I mean, to have all that really out there and quantified undoubtedly is probably very difficult.
I think one of the things that a lot of campus administrators are going to take away from this whole experience is to pay more attention to the students on campus who are completely isolated from the community. And I think, you know, they're not just going to look at the conventional ways of knowing that anymore. The conventional ways were, you know, do you see him hanging out with people in the student union or something like that? Does he get along with his roommate? But also, I think they'll, because social networking has become so ubiquitous, I think that's another question to ask. Does this person participate in the ways that students connect to one another? I was just going to say, as you know, as I was reading the media accounts that Tom's talking about you know, was email the right way to get in touch with the students, I was thinking about what we discussed in one of our first podcasts about, you know, for an awful lot of sort of traditional age college students today, email is a way to get in touch with old people as opposed to being a way to get in touch with each other. And I think we're going to see a lot of looking at text message systems, which could send out, you know, a text message to everyone who subscribes, you know, other ways in addition to email for trying to spread the word about anything in a real hurry.
Tom, do you want to talk a little bit about where this came out of and the software that's running it?
Sure. You know, as you said, Dan, we've been working on this problem of documenting using the web and online communications technologies to document history as it happens, as it were. And we did that with the September 11th Digital Archive. We've done it again with the Hurricane Archive. And when the Virginia Tech tragedy occurred, some colleagues down at Virginia Tech, in particular a guy named Brent Jessick, gave us a call and said, you know, I know you guys have been working on this problem for a while. We're interested in doing the same, something similar. Could you help us out? And in fact, he called it kind of a good moment, because we've been at the Center for History and New Media, we've been trying to generalize some of the technologies that we've used to do these projects into a kind of into a software package that would be easily installable to allow for very kind of rapid reaction, so that historians and other humanists could very quickly set something up, a digital memory bank, as these events happen in their communities. They could be local events, they could be more regional events, more national events, like the Virginia Tech story. Brent called it a good time, because we are moving towards releasing a public beta of this sometime this summer. We're calling it Omeka, which is a Swahili word for to share, to discuss, to lay out for discussion. And so we're moving towards releasing a public beta of that. Right now we've got kind of an alpha version of the software, but it was good enough for Brent and his team, who have some fairly sophisticated skills, to get something up and running very quickly. And it's, you know, when we first launched the 9/11 archive, it took us maybe 3 months to get something up and running. When we launched the Hurricane archive, it took us maybe 3 weeks to get something up and running. We're to the point now where when Brent called, we were able to get something, you know, with our team working on it and his team working on it, get something up and running in about 3 days.
It seems to me that we've gotten a little touchy about certain areas of scholarly communication.
Yeah, well, speaking of, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no. It seems to me, though, that this journal publisher, I mean, they sort of need to do this. They need to go after people who are, you know, supposedly violating their copyrights, because, I mean, they're in the business of protecting a business model that is really coming to the end of its usefulness. It's really so easy to produce the kinds of materials online now that scholarly journals produce, and they charge enormous sums for subscriptions to these journals, and it just doesn't seem like there's a real long-term business model there, unless they really protect their gated materials.
I don't know if the two of you saw Washington Post this morning, but they had a big article on Blackboard, which is of course the by far the largest vendor of these systems, gated courseware systems. I think their market cap just went over $1 billion today.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, again, I think it just, it's sort of all of these stories sort of just show the kind of desperate straits of this, of these business models of gating content. Like, it's just too easy to liberate it. It's too easy for a bunch of, you know, students just to pull down some feeds and throw up a NetVibes page, or use Yahoo Pipes to pull together a whole bunch of content and replicate the kind of functionality that something like Blackboard provides. And there are sophisticated web publishing platforms that are like this new Drupal Ed installation that are being adapted to do a lot of the same kinds of things that that things like Blackboard and WebCT do. And it's just become so easy to do that kind of thing that it just seems, just like with the journal publishing, when it becomes so easy to do it for almost free.
Where do you see things heading in the next, let's say, 5 years in terms of web design? It sounds like CSS was a pretty major revolution in the way the web is designed and implemented and updated. Are there other things like that coming down the pike that our audience should be aware of?
One thing that's really interesting is with the development of CSS, like the first spec, CSS1, came out in 1996. And then CSS2, which were some additions to the language, that came out in 1998. But CSS3 has been in development for the last 10 years, and it hasn't been finalized as a spec. So, I mean, there have been a few designers who have kind of criticize this and wonder where the development of CSS is headed. I'm not really sure if CSS3 will ever be, you know, adopted as a standard and then implemented by browsers.
Right. It seems like a lot of these standards things, like HTML5, has been taking years and years and years. So,
right.
There's a lot of stakeholders. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of concern from, you know, accessibility experts about, you know, changes in HTML5. There was recently, you know, a couple of tags that were intended to be, you know, helpful for accessibility were voted down, and you know, a lot of people have been, you know, criticizing the work group. You know, I'm really not sure where HTML5 is going to be heading in the next year or two.
Right.
But I definitely think that's something to look out for.
It seems that the initial applications had to do with music recommendations, things like that. But I guess it'd be possible for an individual college or university or library or museum to actually set up some kind of internal application or social application within the Facebook platform. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, is that right? The head of Facebook called it a social operating system, which I suppose is ambitious. I guess the peril is that it becomes more like a MySpace, which is far more chaotic. The design degrades. There's possibilities for injecting all kinds of nasty stuff into the Facebook platform. You know, I guess on this show, a couple of episodes ago, we were sort of promoting Facebook as at least it's well designed as opposed to MySpace. And it had certain advantages over MySpace in terms of being better for certainly for colleges and universities, which is its original market. The question now is whether by opening itself up in this way, it becomes a little bit more of a mishmash. And I think professors will begin to shy away from it because of that.
I think that will be the case. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, in a digital age, I guess we get farther and farther away from the originals. And I think that also enables this kind of, you know, fakery and a kind of, you know, legends about what people say when, you know, we're not looking at the originals. We're not going back to the originals very often. I found actually Roy's essay that mentions this, and it's called Digital Archives Are a Gift of Wisdom to be Used Wisely. It was published in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And he mentions that, you know, the use of this online document, which was supposedly an 1829 letter to President Andrew Jackson from Martin Van Buren, who was then governor of New York. And supposedly this letter warned of the threat of the new technology, the railroad, which was going to destroy the old technology of canals. And actually, you can Google this. You can Google, you know, Van Buren railroads, and you'll find a lot of these quotes. And, you know, what I think Roy did is show what, you know, historians always have to do, which was, you know, to really think about, would this have been something that Van Buren would have written or said? And he said it, you know, it sounded suspicious to him and to most American historians, because Van Buren actually opposed federal intervention in the economy. So, but this is a document that had been, you know, spread all over the web, and libertarians had really used it to, you know, basically show what, you know, idiots generally politicians are or liberals are, and, you know, for not letting the free market economy to work. And it's, you know, it's a total fake. You know, it's a good time to sort of pause and think about, you know, how people, our audience, or of listeners can, you know, begin to pick up some of the skills that that people have here at the Center for History and New Media, and in general, in other digital humanities programs, and you know, outside of the academy and libraries and museums, people who work on websites and online exhibits and at libraries and things like cataloging. And you know, I think that you know, this is a real problem for us, you know, now and in the future, because we found that it's becoming increasingly difficult to hire good people, to find particularly programmers. There seems to have been another little bounce in, I guess it's Web 2.0, and the number of people who are kind of going out into the commercial area who have technology skills. And so, you know, we've been sitting around wondering, you know, how are we going to actually find people to do the projects that we want to do? And I think in general, this is really a problem at libraries and museums and universities right now, is sort of finding people who have skills in the humanities, in our case, in history, but who also have technical skills. And we don't really see them coming out of, you know, a traditional, let's say, computer science bachelor's or master's degree. Well, let me say, actually, I have to say, you know, people are saying what a great job Apple did with, like, the hype factor and the publicity and the ramping up and things like that. But I have to say it was a slight letdown, actually, when I used it, just because I had already seen all the functionality in the videos and the blogs and things like that. And so, in an odd way, like, if they had just announced it and said it's available now in the stores, I think I would have been more impressed than I actually was. And I think actually the biggest problem was, and I intentionally did this to make sure I wouldn't walk out of the store with one, of course they have them all set to use the Wi-Fi connection in the AT&T stores.
Yes.
Right. And so I just fidgeted with it and turned it off so it would go onto the cellular network, and it really was slow. And so I have to say that I think I need to wait for, you know, the next generation version. And people say, well, it'll be, you know, Wi-Fi. And of course, this is a good segue, because on campus, you could think, well, you'd have this sort of ubiquitous Wi-Fi connection. But, you know, actually in our building, we have ubiquitous Wi-Fi, but you have to log on through the browser. It's not a seamless experience. And I think that unless this is on Wi-Fi, it is painful when you're using like Google Maps or the Safari web browser. And, you know, so I think I'm just going to wait on it. And I feel like a storm has passed, and I'm not going to whip out my credit card and buy one of these things right away.
Yeah, I think that the slowness of the connection is a problem, and I don't think Wi-Fi is really a real alternative to a cell phone or a real wireless connection. Because, you know, if I'm somewhere where they have Wi-Fi, chances are I also have my laptop in my bag. It's when I don't have my laptop in my bag, when I'm, you know, or I can't access my laptop if I'm in the car or if I'm out on the weekend or something, that I want this connectivity. I think the decision I made to get the BlackBerry instead of the iPhone, I really made it on the basis of the keyboard, and I realized that for me, the thing I needed most was a good email terminal. A mobile email terminal. I live in email. Email is my killer app. And
the lack of a keyboard, a real touch keyboard, a tactile keyboard on the iPhone just did it for me. I thought, you know, 90% of what I'm going to use this for, other than making phone calls, is email. You know, I'm not really going to listen to music on it. I'm not going to watch YouTube, even if that was possible with the connection. I'm gonna write email. So I bought the one that, you know, the product that has been, you know, doing email and doing it well for years. So that was my decision.
It was really fun for me to listen to the clips from the very beginning of the podcast. And I have to say, one of the things that struck me as sort of quaint was our conversation about social media, Facebook in particular, because that was really the early days of Facebook. I thought it was sort of humorous to hear about my students' reactions to the fact that I had gotten a Facebook account and issued friend requests to them, and they were shocked that I could be on Facebook, because that was the days, of course, when you had to have a .edu email address even to sign up for this service that we were still just beginning to call social media. None of us, of course, predicted that Facebook would become the behemoth that it is today, but it was fun listening to our speculations about how it might be used in education, most of which haven't really come true, because by and large, Facebook is really a method of social communication, not an educational platform still today. The second thing that I thought was really interesting to listen to was our conversations about the dawn of the data phone. I think Dan was the only one of us who had succumbed to iPhone mania, and we had fun kidding him about it, but we were speculating about things like sufficient Wi-Fi capacity on campus and what all these data phones would mean for the router systems on our campuses. And of course, now data phones make up the majority of the phones being carried around on our campuses and around in the United States. So again, it was kind of a quaint conversation to listen to. But for me also, it was fun to hear myself predict that there might be a day when I would ask my students to bring their phones to a class to use for accessing the internet and working on class assignments, which in fact is something that I now do. So in my undergraduate course on the history of digital media. So it was kind of fun to think, wow, I actually got one right for a change. And then finally, the thing that struck me in our conversations was how we anticipated the growth of online courses, although in the new media environment, although again, we were just wildly speculating in our conversations about Berkeley's YouTube channel, what this might mean. And of course, none of us could have imagined the world of the MOOC that is sweeping across higher education. But it was still fun to listen to what amounts to sort of early days conversations about how the things like YouTube and video lectures and online delivery of educational content might change what we're doing.
Looks like our good friend Josh Greenberg, who is at the New York Public Library, actually took possession of the first one of these books. This is it's called the Espresso Book Machine, or maybe that's its nickname, but it's basically a refrigerator-sized machine that you press a button and choose a book from many digital offerings, and it prints out a paperback book, I think, in about 5 minutes. And what's amazing is then you look at what else is going on. I mean, Google digitizing all these books and other, you know, Open Content Alliance and all these places digitizing these books and having effectively page images of these that are pretty high quality, although Google's might be a little bit less so. And then the ability to just sort of print this out if you actually want a physical copy.
Yeah, and I think some of the use cases I've seen for, you know, bringing the iPhone into the classroom, I just don't know that this is going to work with, let's say, a big lecture course with, you know, 500 students or 100 students all trying to kind of seamlessly connect to these different access points. And if they have, you know, I guess the Duke administrators were saying it was MAC address requests, and now some other people are blaming the Cisco routers. I think it's going to seriously up the usage of these Wi-Fi networks, because no one will be wanting to use the Edge network, because as we found out, as I found out trying to use the phone, it's painful. And so everyone on campus is going to want to be online all the time in a way that I think the laptops really aren't.
I don't know. The one thing I'd say here, though, is that this could just be a local problem. Like, I don't think it's right to assume that, like, September classes are going to start and, you know, two-thirds of all the students are going to have iPhones. I mean, they are $700 or $600. And, you know, I think there'll be a handful who do have the iPhones, but I think most of them are still going to have, you know, the regular old, you know, $50 flip phone from the carrier. And
right.
I think we probably will have time to catch up.
The first part of the story, which was very interesting about how the technology changes things, is that it's facilitated the organization of a protest in a place where it's very difficult to do that kind of thing. And then there's the history dimension comes in, and this is where it gets really problematic, because the reporter interviewed a couple of people who said, well, and if they'd only had text messaging in 1989, then the whole Tiananmen Square protest movement would have turned out differently. And my response to that was, or not. Yeah, and the example I gave my students was, well, and if the Romans had machine guns, then they would have been able to fight off those barbarians.
Right.
But it seemed to me that this was a nice, sort of an interesting contrast to the story we talked about with Facebook not too long ago, where Facebook has opened up its system to these third-party developers, as opposed to calling them hackers, to create all sorts of new applications for Facebook. And this is, I don't know if you guys have looked at it, but it's really taken off in Facebook. There are a lot of these applications that
are incredibly popular.
It's amazing
how quickly they've gotten developers to do it. And indeed, some of these developers are making good money, and I think there's going to be a good market for these things. I mean, one company that makes one of these Facebook widgets has already been sold for $3 million. So I think there's probably money to be made, but I think more importantly, I think a lot of libraries and campuses are starting to write some applications into that environment because they know that everyone's coming in with a Facebook account.
It just makes no sense to me that Apple would close its system to third-party development. I mean, I know that Apple has always sort of been this way, but you know, with the iPhone, it's really a different environment, I think, than the laptop or the desktop computer environment.
Wikipedia and the quality of what you find on Wikipedia. And some researchers at UC Santa Cruz created some software that uses an analysis of the history of each Wikipedia page. Remember that Wikipedia pages have a history. There's actually a tab, and you can go back and look at every single edit. And some of the pages have literally thousands of edits. And so those kinds of pages tend to be of a higher quality because a lot of people have looked at them and a lot of people have made edits. I guess some of the negatives about blogging, which is, you know, I have come around to that point that it is true that people consider a blog to be a sort of ongoing conversation between the author and an audience. And if you are erratic, it does become easy to kind of tune out a blog. And so I think all of us feel the pressure to post. You know, I have to say on that point, this is part of my impetus to moving from my own blogging software to WordPress was so that I could write drafts. I didn't have a draft capability in my own software. And so one of the things I'm doing now in WordPress is I'll just put a little stub for an article, you know, a title or a few URLs into a draft, and then I'll revisit that. And it might take me months or a couple of days to revisit it.
Part of me thinks it's just kind of a marketing partnership where these institutions are using kind of the marketing reach and power of a brand like the New York Times to bring some money in these non-credit courses. But who knows? Maybe it will actually be a more substantive partnership than that.
And I mean, isn't this something that's been done before? You know, I think inside the article on Inside Higher Ed mentioned Fathom, the initiative company actually set up by Columbia University, I believe, and several other partners that tried to do this in the early part of the decade.
This consolidating function is very important, I think, if you're going to manage so that you have a kind of a single intake point for all of your information, where you can separate the wheat from the chaff and then focus entirely on what's important.
Yeah, I've tried, I think now finally with some success on email prioritization too, because I get just a ton of email from a number of different angles, and you know, projects at the Center for History and New Media, things from students, things from friends and family, things from colleagues, you know, just all kinds of different areas. And you know, I think I've now come in, you know, into a system of, you know, most email programs will allow you to, for instance, flag an email as being important, or that you can rank it. And I would, you know, encourage our audience to check out the various ways of sort of ranking your email. And then you can sort of quickly switch views and see, okay, which ones do I really need to respond to today and which ones can wait a week or a month. Actually, Tom, I took your advice and looked into a little bit on the getting things done system. And I'm not good about systems, as you've probably already figured out.
So I'm up very early in the morning and I sit down at the computer and I work for an hour and a half or so, maybe 2 hours, depending on when everybody else gets up. And so I get work done then, and that's just really the only time of the day when I can carve that out. Because by the end, if I tried to add an hour or two at the end of the day, I wouldn't be able to think straight. So that's really the only way I can do it. And when I'm at my desk at home doing that, I do not connect to the internet.
Hmm. So it seems like we've come full circle. Going off grid does seem to be actually a viable strategy, I suppose, right? It's just unplug, turn off the Wi-Fi.
I think so. I mean, I think one of the things a lot of us have forgotten too is the telephone. I think, you know, we send emails, like Mills said, for all these little thank yous, and we send, you know, we respond to, we take, you know, 20 minutes to craft an email that would take 30 seconds to take care of over the phone. So I think some of the solution is to disconnect.
Right, right. And to use phones, which is precisely the reason that I bought the iPhone this week. As we do every week, we like to end the show with going around the horn and throwing out some links or resources or tools that we found over the past couple of weeks. And maybe we'll start with you this week, Tom.
Yeah, I've got a tool I was talking about, Gmail, and the Google Apps suite that I've been using so much in the last segment. One of the things that makes it actually usable for me is this little Firefox add-on called Customize Google.
One way or another, whether we use Symfony or Google Apps or Zoho or Zimbra or any of these other applications. And also this week, it looks like we're not going to be paying much for premium content anymore either. There's been a lot of buzz about the New York Times basically doing away with Time Select, which was their really what I guess was an experiment to see if they could charge visitors to NewYorkTimes.com for some of the quote-unquote premium content. And by that, they meant op-eds and certain parts of each section. And I think, you know, they seem to have some success on this front. From what I read, there were about 250,000 paying members of Time Select. I mean, I was a member of Time Select, but I get home delivery of the physical paper. So I think there was another 700 or 800,000 Time Select users that were getting home subscriptions and signed up for Time Select for free. So they were making some money, but decided no. The future is really in free content online. You know, despite the burst of the dot-com bubble, that's now come way back up. And, you know, I think you can just project that in the future and look at your server logs and how many people you're turning away for viewing, you know, all these link backs and page views that you're missing out on because your stuff is gated. I imagine that, you know, there was a lot of agitation even before this happened, you know, especially, you know, among the people who, you know, in the New York Times business unit who really understood, you know, what this meant to, like, give away these free eyeballs that were being linked back to their site. And not only that, these articles last for years and years and years. I mean, you Google search some things, you'll get New York Times articles now, and you couldn't before.
Right.
You know, they have permanent URLs for these articles, and so you're just missing out on all that Google traffic that someone Googles a particular topic, and you know, if the New York Times had an article about that, they wouldn't get any of that traffic. So I think this makes a lot of sense, and I think it'll be interesting to see if others open up as well. I guess the Wall Street Journal is the biggest, but there are probably others as well, right? Economist.
Economist is gated.
Yeah. Washington Post is gated.
Right, right. Or at least you have to sign up.
When I first saw that video during the Cal-Tennessee game that I caught a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, it really is a marketing thing. They're marketing on YouTube just the same way that they're marketing during their football games. So,
right. Well, universities out there, take note, that was the 276,133rd time that video has been seen. It's just tremendous. I mean, publicity and, but also, I mean, I, you know, obviously we're being a little bit facetious. I think it's, you know, great. They've got some really interesting courses here, that people could take, online. I mean, everything from, you know, ultraviolet radiation and electrical engineering to, you know, a course by a professor on nonviolence and sort of a historical overview from, you know, Mahatma Gandhi to the American Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King Jr. You know, it's really a kind of nice set of courses. I love their version of Physics for Poets, at least that's what it was called at Princeton. It's called Physics for Future Presidents. As it says, stressing conceptual understanding rather than the math that's normally associated with physics. Anyway, a nice channel, and I think, you know, it's just brilliant to sort of break out of the pack and put this up there quickly. I don't think it's, you know, really that difficult. I also think, you know, the Time Machine, which is a little bit goofy when you look at it, but this is their new backup software, and it looks like you're on the Starship Enterprise as you as stars go by, and I mean it's actually pretty visually arresting, but going back in time you see sort of windows that are your machine in prior incarnations as you go back through time to retrieve, for instance, a file that you deleted. Now, of course, again, this is something that's been around in computer science forever. You know, for a long time I used to back up with a command line utility called rsync, which I assume Time Machine is just, you know, a graphical version of rsync, because, you know, Mac OS X is Unix under the hood, and I assume they're just using one of these Unix utilities for backing up. They've made it look really good. But again, isn't this what Apple does really well? I mean, they just take something that's kind of been out there and make it so visually nice looking that you want to use it. And I know so many people who do not back up that having something that looks this good and that is this easy, you just plug in a hard drive, it says, do you want this to be a Time Machine? And you say yes, and that's it. You know, doesn't that just make it used more? You know, now they're in the tens of millions. I can't remember the last number I saw, but I think they're somewhere around 50 or 60 million. Still half the number of MySpace, but clearly they're growing very rapidly, and there's been a lot of interest in, you know, buying Facebook and buying into Facebook. Which indeed Microsoft did for the stunning amount of $240 million for, from what I understand, just about 1.5% of the company, which values it at $15 billion with a B. And it, you sort of write one once and it will run on all these things. And Facebook, to justify this $15 billion valuation of their company, is going to put out something called social ads. And I think really what's happening here is that they are finally leveraging to the fullest extent. They're already started to do this since they have ads on the site. But social ads is going to take into account all that personal information that you've put into your Facebook account. You know, they know what movies you like. They know what bands you like. They know who you're friends with. They have all this information, and you know, I think for me, what I've seen over the last year, and I think this is very typical, is that you know, as Google has grown and, you know, its stock went way up this week to over $700. They're now the fifth most valuable company in the United States. People always, I think, attack the big guy. And there's been a lot of critics of Google. And in particular, the criticism of Google has been one about privacy, that Google has all this information. You do all these searches on Google and they know what you're interested in. But my goodness, Facebook has much better information, as far as I can tell, than Google does. So what I've done on a lot of things is just reduce the privacy settings so that only my friends can see things like, you know, what bands I like, or, you know, what I'm doing right now. But unless you do that, the default settings are very, very liberal, I guess we could call them. Looks like an interesting initiative. I mean, basically they're trying to help out, you know, make the process, and we know this very well, of getting a podcast online is pretty difficult. And I think particularly in a live setting for lectures, Mills, you know this pretty well. It's not that easy, right, Mills?
Right. Well, I mean, it's not that easy if you actually want to edit what you're going to post. I mean, it's actually now pretty simple through iTunes U for me to just record my class and dump it straight into iTunes U. But that's then a really big file. You know, my classes last an hour and 15 minutes, and I don't really want to podcast the entire class. If I were just going to podcast the whole class, it would really be pretty simple. But I end up going back and editing just sort of highlights of the class and posting that instead. And so that's what takes the time. But the interface is not bad. There's a problem, though, with the iTunes U interface at the moment, which is that anybody – with administrative access to the account can edit any site. So one of my colleagues accidentally deleted my picture and sent me an email saying, oh, sorry about that. You might want to put it back. So, you know, they're still working out some of the kinks on that. But in terms of just recording the class and dumping it straight into the iTunes U account and then having it appear online, that's pretty easy now. Is it going to be just a different computer platform, like a slightly bigger cell phone or a slightly smaller laptop, that ultimately becomes the primary reading platform for people? Right now what they're trying to do is take a book and make it digital, which it's kind of like taking a bike and making it fly. You know, books were not intended to be digital. And so it's taking one technology and trying to force it onto another technology.
Right.
So I think maybe they're going about it the wrong way.
I just don't think the students want to, you know, have little pop-ups in that about their library books being overdue. You know, I know a lot of libraries are pursuing this, and maybe there's something there. And, you know, I have to admit, since I'm going to, you know, we're throwing stones in glass houses here, maybe, but, you know, we'll probably build some Facebook applications for Zotero. I'm just not sure that it's the place for it.
But I just, honestly, I wasn't going to put up the whole class because I wanted them to actually come to class. Otherwise, I'd be kind of lonely there in the classroom just talking to myself and my microphone.
Right. Well, I guess since it's the end of the semester, should we tell all of our students that the Digital Campus Podcast is not a substitute for live interaction with your professor or other students in your class?
Right now, for me, it's kind of funny to talk about this because I force my students to turn off their phones when they come into class. But I could imagine a day not very far off where I'm providing them with educational content access, whether it's a podcast or just a series of images that I want them to think about or something like that, and they can pull it down to their phone. Now, it used to be that phone screens were so small that would be kind of ridiculous. But now, I mean, if you look at the iPhone screen, the BlackBerry screen, some of the bigger sort of sidekick screens, they can, you know, not only can they read a lot of text and look at images that way, they do. And, you know, also we're seeing phones increasingly being multimedia devices, showing video or holding sound files, and so, you know, as a one-stop device, I think the phone has a lot more possibility for educational purposes.
Delivering texts and images to people as they walk around the battlefield, images of those locations, texts about the locations where they happen to find themselves. But I think there's also a possibility, because it really is not just a delivery platform, it's actually an interactive platform. I think there are some really interesting possibilities for allowing especially students to interact with the historical and cultural landscape. So one of the things I would really love to do, and I've thought about, and Mills and I have talked about a bunch, is, for instance, a scavenger hunt of sorts on the National Mall here in Washington.
These are the best people at Yale. I mean, the best lecturers at Yale. So in political science, they have the intro course from Stephen Smith, who I've taught with. And he's terrific. He's funny. He's approachable. And he's brilliant. And so I think this is much like when we played the Berkeley YouTube channel on this podcast. I think this is a great PR move for universities. And I think they're going to end up not opening it up. I think most professors' stuff will remain locked up, but they're going to put their superstars out there on the web and use this as a marketing tool. Those who've been following the digital campus saga on this year will know, and probably be surprised that this is not number one, considering yours truly and what happened over the summer. Well, iPhone makes an impact. Certainly a big story this year. I guess really iPhone, Tom and Mills, this is maybe a stand-in for us for, I think it really opened up people's eyes to the possibilities of what a cell phone could be. And we discussed this last week on the podcast that really we think 2008 will be the year in which the phone as a learning platform, as an educational platform, as a campus and library and museum messaging platform is really going to take off.
And I think it's also inspired educators to think that, well, there could be actually educational applications developed for this platform as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this sort of ties into what I was saying about earlier about Second Life. I think the genius of Facebook is that it does a very good job of supplementing real world relationships. I mean, I think it allows you to extend those relationships sort of in time and in space. And so relationships that students have in the dorms can continue while they're home on holiday break, or they can continue relationships students have and this is, I think, the potential for education. Relationships students have in the classroom can extend when they leave the classroom, and that's, I think, the beauty and the potential of Facebook. I think we've also this year talked about a lot of the problems with Facebook as well, privacy concerns and Beacon and other things being probably first and foremost. But I think it really was the story of 2007, and it'll be interesting, I think, to see whether it maintains its momentum in 2008 or whether something overtakes it, either in the social networking arena or in some other area of digital campus technology, such as the cell phone.
I have to say, I found it pretty difficult to listen to all of that, in part because I just can't stand the sound of my own voice, though you wouldn't know it from how much I blather on, but mostly because I feel like we're still talking about many of the same issues that we were talking about when the podcast started in 2007. That could be, I suppose, our obsession with a few particular topics, among them Google Books, intellectual property, mobile technology, social media, web development, and some others. But I think it's not that. I don't think it's just because we've stood still. I actually think we started the podcast at a time when there was maybe at the peak of a certain period of innovation when things like the iPhone were coming out, things like Facebook were gaining ground. And since then, in the past 5 years or more, we've been in more of a period of stasis where there isn't a whole lot new and revolutionary on the horizon. Despite claims to the contrary, I don't think tablet computing is all that revolutionary. I think the big leap that was made was the leap that was made with the iPhone. And then, the iPad and Android devices and other things are variations on a theme, and some of them very compelling ones. But in general, I think a lot of the issues are very much the same. I mean, we're still talking about models for open access. We still haven't hit on any real successful ones, I don't think, or we're maybe just starting to. But I think that the issues surrounding open access, for instance, are very much the same kinds of issues that we were talking about in 2007. So, I mean, I hate to sound like a pessimist, and that, and I'm certainly not bored with talking about these issues. I think that there are issues that are still incredibly compelling and in need of serious discussion. But I'm struck by the fact that we are still in a period of real flux, and we still have a lot of work to do to get us over a certain hump, so to speak. I'm reminded of something Clay Shirky said in a piece that he wrote around about the same time that we started the podcast called Thinking the Unthinkable. And it was a piece that was about the future of journalism. And he wrote in that piece that nothing will work, but everything might. And I think that's still very true of technology in museums, libraries, and on campus. We don't know which of these things that are starting to look a little run-of-the-mill will be the ones that are truly revolutionary. We don't know which of the technologies, which of the everything will be the ones to make a real difference in the next couple of years. And our job is to continue to stay on top of them and to continue especially to experiment. And as we do that, some will matter and others won't. But we won't see that at the time we're discussing them. We won't see that at the time that they're being developed. And I suppose then that's an argument to carry on with this podcast into the next 100 episodes. And I really look forward to doing that and to doing that with my friends, Dan and Amanda and Stephen and Mills and all of you. Thanks for the opportunity for reaching out to all of you and for listening. It's been a tremendous pleasure and a real thrill.
We have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.